Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
There was once a land where the weather was very, very strange. There were awful heat waves in some parts, and in others, terrible storms and floods.
Greenhouse gas.
Heating the world.
Friends, did a month of rainfall late last night. Rivers flood in the fall. 214 all-time heat records in the U.S. September 24th. 30 degrees in Toronto, feeling like 37 with the humidity, the heat of the human body. Worried about your kids? You might have post-climatic stress disorder. Yes, PTSD is a serious condition, but don't worry. Professional help is on the way.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay.
Climate Psychology 101, kids, with psychologist Robert Kiffert and Joseph Reeser, plus new film on the granddaddy of the double bind, Gregory Bateson.
Dr. Joseph Reeser is adjunct associate professor in the School of Psychology at Griffith University in Queensland, Australia. He has written extensively on environmental psychology. From Australia, Joseph Reeser, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
Hi there. Well, Dr. Reeser, we have enough science to know climate change is happening. We have the numbers, the satellite data, historic records, endless measurements. And yet, climate legislation failed to appear in North America and lots of other places in the world. It's a free-for-all to dump more greenhouse gases. This seems to be a failure of the human mind to grasp our situation. Can psychology help?
Well, certainly they can help. I mean, it's our business, I guess, to look at how people make sense out of the world in which they live and how that influences their behavior. And I think one of the things that's been missed a little bit with respect to psychology and climate change, if you want, is that how people are making sense out of this event really matters. It really matters in terms of the actions that they take. It really matters in terms of the impact that this threat has on their lives and circumstances. And if we really want to be effective in changing people's behavior, then we need to better understand public understandings of this phenomenon.
Could you tell us about the new report on the climate from the American Psychological Association?
The American Psychological Association was very keen to kind of communicate what psychology has to offer, you know, in a collaborative way to climate change science, because we keep hearing in discussions of climate change mitigation and adaptation, and there seems to be very little reference to human experience, to how this is impacting on individuals, to taking action at an individual level. You know, the conversation has been very much about structural considerations. And actually, we do have a lot of very good data about human response to situations like this. And I guess we are keen to be able to communicate this to other scientists and also for them to understand that, for example, climate change adaptation is not just about system and structural adaptation. It's very much about human experience and human adaptation. And that actually we've been talking about psychological adaptation for the last 100 years, and yet it doesn't seem to be on the radar of climate change scientists.
Listeners, I'm going to put a link to that American Psychological Association report in the Radio EcoShock blog. You just go to ecoshock.info and you'll find it. You just finished some research on the attitudes of Australians toward climate change. What did you find?
Well, what we found, we were working collaboratively with Cardiff University in the UK, and because they've been looking at public attitudes and responses to climate change and energy futures there for a number of years. And energy futures in the UK and Europe generally are tied up with nuclear power plants, and as to whether that might be a kind of a more palatable, I guess, to the voting electorate now that carbon emissions seem to be a quite serious problem. But in Australia, there hadn't ever been any kind of in-depth national research with respect to, well, how does the public understand the phenomenon of climate change? And basically what we found, I mean, we're still working through our data, but certainly we found very high levels of concern, both in Australia and the UK, almost identical levels of concern, which is very discrepant from a lot of media coverage of this notion that there's kind of what we would call a risk attenuation, that climate change seems to be, you know, 17th down the list on people's list of concerns. Well, that's not what our findings say at all. Our findings suggest that climate change is very salient. People are very concerned. They understand climate change in a different way. There's a myth out there that public understandings of climate change is about understanding climate change science. Well, I don't think that's the case at all. I think people understand climate change in very human, you know, cultural terms, and that may not equate very closely at all with climate change science. And so we can't really measure public understandings of climate change by seeing what, how well they understand the science. Public understandings are a different kind of thing. But there's no doubt that people are not only very concerned about it, that it's impacting on people's lives and experience. We included measures of psychological distress with respect to what seems to be happening around them, and those measures indicated considerable psychological distress in Australia. We also looked closely at how people understood kind of natural disaster phenomena as compared with global climate change. And in Australia, the language of climate change is very much the language of natural disasters. Climate change, if you want, has become the idiom of distress for many problems that people see in the world and in the Australian context. So when people are talking about, you know, floods or drought or cyclones or bushfires, the rhetoric, the talk is very much about climate change. That things are changing. These are the manifestations of it. So in Australia, perhaps in a somewhat different way than North America, climate change is here now in people's face. And it's a real concern and issue in rural and remote mental health, for example, in Australia. And again, in a way that it is not, I think, in North America.
Yes, people have had to leave their farms because of the drought. You had those tremendous firestorms, which were deadly as well, and floods at the same time. So I can see how people might be coming around, as they are in Russia after the events with the heat storm in Moscow and the fires outside of it. You know, I first heard you on an excellent ABC national radio program called All in the Mind. And in that program, you said that there were no psychologists and very few social scientists involved in writing that big climate report for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. Why not, and why should they have been there?
Well, I think in a way the origins of the international panel and the climate change science focus on this phenomena, you know, I guess it was spearheaded by natural scientists and physical geographers and climatologists and a large interdisciplinary group of people that work on these kind of global patterns, global issues. Indeed, internationally, there's been funding for global environmental change for the last 30 years, substantial funding. That now is more spoken of in terms of climate change, but that focus and emphasis has been there for a very long time. But I think in a way that there's always been a kind of marginalization of psychology and social science with respect to environmental problems generally. And that's particularly unfortunate because sociologists and anthropologists and psychologists and political scientists, we've been working on environmental issues since the late 60s, you know, and there's a wealth of data about understanding why people behave in particular ways that have adverse environmental impacts, and also how adverse environmental impacts really influence people's concerns and anxieties and quality of life. And so I think that this is just a good example of that. But what our mission was, I guess, is to communicate to not only climate change scientists and policymakers, but we're really talking about profoundly important changes in the human environment as well as the biophysical environment here, and certainly very powerful impacts on the human environment as well as the physical environment, and that we need to better understand both of these, particularly if the challenges that are facing us are how to turn people's behavior around and also how to assist people and communities in coping with what may be a very apocalyptic event, in that climate change for many social and physical scientists is a global natural disaster, a global emergency, but it may be with us for the next few thousand years. And we really need to focus on the human side of this as well as the biophysical side of this.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Joseph Reeser from the School of Psychology at Griffith University in Australia. You've raised a point that I've been thinking about for some time, that millions of good people are not only blocked from action by the overwhelming fear of more chaos, let us say, in the natural world, but they are suffering psychologically. Do you see a new therapeutic field developing to help people through, say, climate anxiety?
I see a sort of an expansion of what is there. I mean, I do a lot of work in natural disasters. Disaster mental health is kind of a very big area that's been going for a very long time. You know, like what we, some of my work in Australia, for example, is to help people to psychologically prepare for cyclones or hurricanes in North American terms, and bushfires and other disasters as well. And then the reality is that it's, the psychological reality is that it is hard for people to think about these events because they're quite frightening often. They often are not as physically prepared as they should be for these events, but more importantly, they're not psychologically prepared. Often people, particularly people who have no experience, for example, being in a hurricane, they have no idea how they're going to be feeling and responding to the events that are going to encircle them in that situation. And so what we advocate is assisting people to be better psychologically prepared for disasters generally, and then they're usually better situationally prepared for that. But basically, there's a large literature there that's very helpful, really, in terms of, well, how are people kind of getting their heads around the situation of global environmental change and what consequences are going to be for the environment and for people. And to do that, we need to look more closely at how they're making sense out of this event. And what we tend to forget is that for most of the people in the developed and urban world, their encounter with global climate change is through the media. You know, it's indirect, it's virtual, it's very psychologically unreal in many ways. You know, how do we discriminate between the coverage of what might be happening at the South Pole or, you know, in Africa or Southeast Asia from an environmental documentary? It's very hard to, you know, discriminate between fiction and fact. And, of course, the whole phenomena of climate change is very complex. There seems to be a lot of discrepant information that comes from the media. The media is given equal time to scientists and climate change skeptics, even though scientists, you know, are 99% very worried about this problem. But the public could be excused for thinking that there's some real controversy out there because of the way things are covered. And so we have to understand that there's a certain level of psychological unreality about all of this for people in terms of understanding it, in terms of making it personal and asking how it's going to affect their own lives and their own community, you know, their own local environment. I think we totally forget about that. We think that everybody's directly in touch with this global climate change phenomena. Well, that just doesn't make sense.
It's true, but I think the media coverage does have an impact. Many of the people that I talk to, at least those who become more aware of climate change, they go through a period of deep fear for their children and their grandchildren about what's coming up. And I'm just to take the devil's advocate here, maybe we shouldn't try and lull people or heal people, because this personal pressure may be needed to drive a change in lifestyle and get them to demand real change from politicians. Maybe, can people be frightened into making the right choices? Will they ever change without some painful stimulus forcing them to?
Oh, look, you're absolutely right in many ways, because this has been a real challenge in health psychology, for example, or the health profession generally. You need to tailor your risk communications, whether it be, alcohol or smoking or cancer, carcinogens. You need to tailor your information so that people are very concerned about a very real problem, but not so overwhelmed by anxiety that they don't take the corrective action that's necessary. So we're always looking at how to get the fear appeal right. And I think with respect to climate change, that there is a problem in terms of how the media has been dealing with it. I mean, they have quite rightly saying this is a profound issue, and that it's a global peril that we have to take very seriously, and we have to change our lives accordingly. But I think that you also have to make it personal to people in a particular way, so that it's personally meaningful. What has happened in the media coverage is that it's very global. For example, if you look at media coverage, you know, it's polar bears marooned on ice floes, or things that are happening at the poles, or in the Sahel in Africa, in other places. And people look out their kitchen window, and everything looks pretty well okay. And so they're getting these images that are very psychologically distant. They're distant in space. They're distant in time in terms of when this could happen. They acknowledge that, yes, there seem to be real problems out there, but they're not of immediate personal consequence, and they're not of particular consequence, perhaps, to their own local environment. And part of that is because the images are all global. And also then people kind of unconsciously say to themselves, well, these problems seem to be caused by and a consequence for people elsewhere. They should shoulder the responsibility for that. If something was happening in my own local community, I'd be very concerned about that. I'd be out there doing something about it. But everything sort of looks okay here. And also, if it's truly a global problem, what could I do about it anyway? And so there's this offloading of responsibility to that global community. It's kind of their problem. And I think there is a way to make the global local. There is a way to get people to think globally, act locally, and respond personally. And that's a way of bringing kind of the ecosphere home, in a way, to people. And so even in health communications, we have to take the problem and the anxiety that might be raised, and at the same time give people some practical things that they can do about that, and not just about the environmental problem, but they need some practical strategies for how to cope with how they're feeling about this. You know, some psychological advice to kind of how to handle this and still go on and, you know, engage in some behavior that's going to be meaningful in terms of carbon reduction and in terms of addressing the problem. People want to do the right thing. They want to feel that they're responsible, that they're kind of aware of and of the problem and really doing something about it. But they need some assistance sometimes, both in good information about what they can actually do about the problem in terms of their own life circumstances, but they also need some good psychological information about how they might be feeling in the face of what looks like a pretty apocalyptic scenario here. And that's missing at the moment.
So if we were to get out of our car and take the bike one time a week to work, that may not save the planet or the atmosphere, but it has a deep feeling for ourselves and makes us feel better about ourselves, and maybe that's important too.
Yes, I think there's been a problem in the way it's been framed. For example, there's so much discussion about environmentally significant behavior, which really is about adaptation and reduction of carbon emissions, as though that's the only thing that matters. Well, what really matters to people is that what they're doing is psychologically meaningful. So I and other psychologists have been saying that we need to look at psychologically significant behavior as well as environmentally significant behavior. In fact, they go hand in hand, because if what you're doing is not psychologically significant, then you're not going to be doing what is environmentally significant. And the counter to that, some people would say, oh, you're just engaging in some kind of self-therapy here. It's really not doing anything relating to the problem. But that's to completely miss the point that, you know, what we're doing has to be psychologically meaningful for us to keep doing it, for us to be kind of working on that larger mitigation problem as well. And really, the whole world now is focusing on adaptation, because so much is now set in concrete. You know, so the next 100 years is going to play out pretty much the way it's shaping up, no matter what is done. But the next 1,000 years really matters. So I'm not saying that people shouldn't be focusing on environmentally significant behavior. But there's this immediate need to really look at how people are dealing with this, how they're coping. And the thing is that taking action in one's local environment has multiple benefits. Not only do you feel empowered. You know, you're not engaged in the denial and learned helplessness you might be feeling anyway. You can feel that you're doing the right thing. You can feel that you're being part of the solution, not just part of the problem. You can kind of take meaningful steps to change your life circumstances and your personal footprint on the planet. But that isn't just the simple kind of thinking, globally, acting locally. It really requires this responding personally, so that when you engage in behaviors that might otherwise be absent-minded, for example, in terms of not buying bottled water or riding your bike instead of taking your car, you need to be mindful that actually this really matters, you know, that I have this relationship with my local natural environment. I can see the effects that my own actions take in my local environment, but because I'm engaged in this, I sort of immediately understand that there are larger planetary systems at play here. There are interdependencies, you know, that this is spaceship Earth. You know, I live in a compartment of it, and that what I do really does matter, not only to me and my community and my local environment, but we're all part of this whole. And that's where this responding personally is really the missing link in thinking globally, acting locally. And I guess what we've been trying to do is take this simple notion, this distilled wisdom of thinking globally, acting locally, and saying, look, you know, there's some very important psychological considerations here. And in a larger way, these psychological considerations are missing in the climate change science debate, and they have to be there. You know, we're not going to change behavior by excluding psychology, sociology, anthropology. These are critical disciplines.
I appreciate what you're saying. We're going to put the personal back in, and we're going to put the human back in. We have been talking with Dr. Joseph Reeser, an expert in climate psychology from Griffith University in Queensland, Australia. Dr. Reeser, thank you so much for your insight.
You're most welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith, asking, why don't we do more to prevent climate change? Why? For that, we need to enter the puzzle of the human mind. Our guide is a world-recognized expert in the psychology of climate change. Dr. Robert Gifford is a professor of psychology and environmental studies at the University of Victoria in British Columbia, Canada. He's taught there since 1979. He's a fellow of both the Canadian and American Psychological Associations. He helped found the Pacific Institute for Climate Change Solutions, and he's written so many science publications and many book chapters. He's the editor of the Journal of Environmental Psychology. Let's talk with him now. Robert Gifford, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad you're here, too, because we have some problems we do have to sort out. You know, most of our Radio EcoShock interviews are with scientists studying physical things like ancient rocks, melting ice, or rising temperatures. Why is psychology so often left out of the climate change debate?
I think there's a number of reasons, but maybe I'm thinking in particular of a quote by Robert Heinlein, if you want to have a half-science connection here, who said back in 1953, man, as he said at that point, is not a rational animal. He's a rationalizing animal. And so a lot of the problems have to do with people not being rational about environmental issues.
In order to express some of your rather complex ideas about climate psychology, you've developed the model of dragons. Can you explain that general concept for us?
Yes. Dragons is a metaphor that I use for what could be stated as the reasons why we don't do things that even we think we should do, but as opposed to people who don't even think we need to do anything about the climate or global warming.
But these aren't really mythological things. These are ideas or behaviors that you can find in people and to some degree measure?
Right. Dragon is just something that came to me in the middle of the night one day, and I agree that dragons are metaphorical or mythical, I suppose. But these barriers, if we want to use more plain English, we could also call them barriers or obstacles to action.
We won't have time to explore all the 13 dragons that you found just so far. Let's talk the top most prevalent ones that you did find from a survey of Canadians, and that was done in Ontario, and 41% of those surveyed had this one, which you called perceived behavioral control. What does that mean, and how do we experience it?
Well, I have to, Alex, I have to tell you that since I did that, the dragons are kind of in their den doing what dragons do, and they've been multiplying. There are now 29 of them. So just so that your listeners know, there's a lot more than 13 now. But to answer your question, perceived behavioral control, or PBC, is the sense that I don't have the power or efficacy to change the situation. So it wouldn't help if I did something because I don't have the power to make a difference by myself. Well, it's similar to the voting problem. My one vote won't change anything, so I'm not going to vote. But if we translate that to what we're talking about, if I ride my bike to work or to school, it's such a small drop in the bucket and such a big cost to me, getting wet in the rain or what, getting potential for risk of injury at whatever cost of a new bike, that I just don't think I'll do it because it's not going to make enough of a difference.
And then the second most high-rated excuse for inaction was social norms and equity. What do you mean by that?
We're all, whether we want to admit it or not, heavily influenced by the significant others around us, the people that we admire that are close to us. Whether it's a boss or a spouse or a friend or a family member or somebody we admire. And those people have a lot of influence on our choices. So if we happen to be in a group of significant others who are doing what we could call the wrong thing, then there's going to be a lot of influence on us to follow that norm. But it can obviously work the other way if I'm part of a group of people who are trying to do everything they can to reduce their carbon footprint, for example, then I'm probably going to be influenced that way as well. So we're more influenced than maybe we want to believe by what other people do, that other people that we admire and like do.
Sure, we see successful people and they're driving very good cars and they're flying all over the world and they're leading a high-carbon lifestyle and we would like to be like them. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Oh, of course, yeah. And some very interesting studies showing the power of norms might take longer than we have here, but to try to summarize this, because it's a, sort of a modern classic, when people in Southern California were told on their electricity bill that they were using more energy or less energy than the average resident of their neighborhood, they tended to change their actual electricity use just by looking at their electricity bill.
The category you labeled reactants didn't really surprise me. I found, especially in young males, a group of people who think they can express their individuality through rebellion. We see all kinds of YouTube videos that speak to me that way. They think it's cool to go against common perception, and they deny that climate change exists or that humans have anything to do with it. Now, do I have that right? Would that be reactants, or do you mean something different from that?
Well, it's a little bit different from that, Alex, although what you talked about is the result of the original impulse. A reactant is the sense that somebody is taking away our freedom. So we lash out or act out in the ways that you mentioned, but the source of that is I don't want anybody to tell me what to do, especially if it's something I don't want to do. It's a sort of two-year-old mentality, if you will, that occurs sometimes even people older than 2 years old.
It's a huge social phenomenon, maybe the Tea Party movement.
Oh, boy, I think there's a strong connection to the Tea Party movement. Yeah, I mean, one of the main themes, of course, of the Tea Party movement is smaller government, unless it means you're cutting off subsidies to my coal mine. But generally, it's, you know, I don't want big government because I don't want government to tell me what to do. So it's that Tea Party is heavily influenced by reactants.
Of course, I don't want to put that down. I mean, I don't want government to tell me what to do about something. So there is a valid feeling, perhaps, in this.
Well, it's not a matter of valid or not. It's reality. It's human nature and reality. So you can put a positive valence on it or a negative valence. It's all of these dragons are real, and then it's a matter of dealing with them after that.
Well, the final one I'd like to bring out is outright denial. What is behind this, and how does it operate?
I've learned from talking to quite a few people about this, that, you know, to be fair, there's a kind of a range of skepticism and denial. As one denial intellectual PhD denier said to me, you know, why are you complaining when people raise issues about climate change, but you wouldn't criticize me if I raised issues about some other scientific theories? That is, there is a legitimate role for balanced questioning, let's say, of any scientific enterprise. And that's on the end of denial and skepticism that I would say is maybe not such a bad thing. And some things have, in the IPCC report, et cetera, have been uncovered. And, you know, the IPCC group and report isn't perfect. And most of the authors of it would agree.